I did my first show on the housing and subprime mortgage bubble in early 2007, and I have watched and questioned and commented in anger and sadness as our economic and financial troubles were too long ignored, then demagogued with panic in late 2008, and I would say inadequately and inaccurately dealt with ever since. When appropriate, I like to use a format on this show that I call It's Broke, Let's Fix It, in which we focus on an issue, in this case the economy or the Great Recession, and ask three big questions. How is it broken? What's the evidence? How did it get broken? What's the history, the causes, the culprits? And finally, how do we fix it? What are the solutions? Now, to take on this big and complex a subject in that fashion could only make sense if my guest were one of very few people in the world. And today's guest, economist Joseph Stiglitz, is one of those people. On Free Forum, we explore the lives, the work, the ideas of individuals that I suspect have pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. We look at new, innovative, provocative approaches to business, environment, health, science, politics, media, culture, all based on the fact that I believe we can do better, and I want to find out how. Joseph Stiglitz became a full professor at Yale in 1970 at the age of 27. And in 1979, he was awarded the John Bates Clark Award as the economist under the age of 40 who had made the most significant contribution to the field. He's taught at Princeton, Stanford, MIT, and Oxford, and is now university professor at Columbia University, chair of Columbia's Committee on Global Thought, and co-founder and executive director of the Initiative for Policy Dialogue. In 2001, he was awarded the Nobel Prize in Economics, and he was also a lead author of the 1995 report of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which shared the 2007 Nobel Peace Prize. Stiglitz was a member and chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors during the Clinton administration. He then became chief economist and senior vice president at the World Bank. In 2008, he was asked by French President Sarkozy to chair the Commission on the Measurement of Economic Performance and Social Progress. And in 2009, was appointed chair of the UN's Commission of Experts on Reform of the International Financial and Monetary System, and both of those committees released their reports in September 2009. He's the author of, among other books, Globalization and Its Discontents, Fair Trade for All, Making Globalization Work, The $3 Trillion War, The True Cost of the Iraq Conflict, with Linda Bilmes, and his newest, Free Fall, America, Free Markets, and the Sinking of the World Economy. Welcome, Joseph Stiglitz.
Nice to be here.
Thank you. And I think I interviewed you on Making Globalization Work and then on the $3 trillion war, so it's very good to have you back with me.
Nice to be back.
I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas that we talk about. So as I just read your bio, it's clear that you for years have actively combined world-class academic work and a deep and passionate involvement with the real world. And as I read, for two decades now, at the very highest levels. How did you begin to do that? And have there been challenges associated with that mix?
Well, actually, very early on in my career, I was very interested in issues of public policy. One of the first books I wrote was on the economics of the public sector. Trying to understand how economics apply to government. And one of the themes of my own research has been to help us understand better the balance between market and the government. Well, in those roles, I often got asked for my advice, my views on a whole range of issues, from environmental issues to issues of land agreements between the Seneca Indians and the U.S. government. And so in a piecemeal way, I got into these issues until in 1993, President Clinton asked me to come to Washington to be on his Council of Economic Advisors. And, of course, that was really how I became, you might say, immersed in these issues.
In layperson's terms, because it's interesting, I remember, I think I asked you this question years ago, the first time I interviewed you, but in looking at this crisis and in looking at free fall, it's a critical piece there. What was your Nobel awarded for?
It was awarded to me for my work on asymmetric information, imperfect information. Idea was very simple. For 200 years or more, the development of economics had been predicated on assumptions that there was perfect information. Now, it was an absurd assumption.
Yeah, I know. It's so funny when I first read that, and I thought, let me see. So it took 200 years for someone to point this out, and they get a Nobel for it.
Well, it wasn't that economists didn't know that information was imperfect, but they didn't know how to deal with it. And there were many economists who believed, or you might say hoped, prayed, that a world in which their information was not too imperfect would be close to, well described by, a model in which information was perfect.
So in other words, you'd make assumptions, and the fact that it wasn't so in the real world wouldn't ultimately matter.
That was the hope. That was the hope. And then my own research breakthrough was to figure out ways to analyze markets with imperfect information. And in fact, to begin to conceptualize what even that meant, various ways in which information was imperfect. There's only one way in which information is perfect, then you know everything. But information can be imperfect in a variety of ways, and to try to think about this systematically was not that easy. So you might say the luck, the breakthrough, was to develop a set of ways of thinking about this, which revolutionized economics. And then it turned out that this presumption that had prevailed for more than 200 years, that a world with imperfect information, so long as it was not too imperfect, would be similar to one with perfect information, that presumption was totally destroyed. And the new theory was enabled us to at last begin to understand some phenomena that traditional economics couldn't say anything about. For instance, traditional economics says that demand always equals supply. And one application of that is the demand for labor equals the supply of labor. To put it another way, there's no such thing as unemployment. Now, that's an absurd assumption or absurd result, but it was so ingrained in economic doctrines that there are even today many economists who believe that there's no such thing as unemployment. There are some economists at a variety of universities in America, not so strong elsewhere, who say all that's going on today is that some people are enjoying a little bit more leisure than they normally do. Of course, the reality is that more than one out of six Americans who would like a full-time job cannot get one. That's an example you were outlining before. How do we know something isn't working? Well, when so many Americans want jobs and can't get them, that's not the way the economy is supposed to work.
Right. I want to read a couple of quotes from Making Globalization Work, which is from how many years ago? Five? Six?
Well, 4 years ago, 2006.
Okay. And when I read them, they seem to apply very well to the current crisis. So the first one is, this book is as much about how politics has been used to shape the economic system as it is about economics itself. Economists believe incentives matter. There are strong incentives and enormous opportunities to shape political processes and the economic system in ways that generate profits for some at the expense of the many. Not news to most of my listeners, but do you want to say a few words about that? Because you were saying it in terms of globalization, and yet, my God, does it apply to the crisis?
I agree. And as somebody remarked, never have so many given so much to so few, as in our recent bank bailouts, and you might say to so few who were so undeserving. This is a real example of this crisis of what I wrote. I had forgotten about those particular words, but when you remind me, one of the things that I say in my new book, Free Fall, is that the one thing that economists agree on is incentives matter. And the bankers had incentives to engage in excessive risk-taking, to engage in short-sighted behavior, and that's what they did. So we shouldn't be surprised in many ways with what's happened. In fact, I was in the almost uncomfortable position of having predicted that this you might say, bad behavior would be the consequences of these flawed incentives.
Yes, it's interesting, you know, I mean, I'm going to get to it later, but when I looked at, like, if there were two things that economics is supposed to deal with, incentives is one and risk is the other. I mean, there are others, but those are two of the big ones. And my God, did that all go awry. Let me read you another quote from Making Globalization Work. Open democratic processes can circumscribe the power of special interest groups. We can bring ethics back into business. Corporate governance can recognize the rights not only of shareholders, but of others who are touched by the actions of corporations. An engaged and educated citizenry can understand how to make globalization work, or at least work better, and can demand that their political leaders shape globalization accordingly. Now, I think one could substitute democracy or the economy for globalization there. Be honest, can what you described happen without public financing of political campaigns, especially in light of the Supreme Court's recent decision removing all limits from corporate contributions to campaigns?
Well, it's obviously a very important reform. I still am hopeful that we can, you know, you might say it's an unlevel playing field. It's a unfair game. But in the end, voters matter. And one of the things that we're seeing right now is that there is so much anger about what has been happening, about the banks having received so much, paying out so much in bonuses, while so many Americans, the rest of the country, suffering so much, unemployment, foreclosures, businesses going bankrupt. That incongruity is leading to a voter backlash. Now, unfortunately, some of that is, you might call, inchoate. That is to say, people know that they're angry, they know that something is wrong, but to go back to what you said in your introduction, they don't know exactly how to fix it. And unfortunately, some people's prescriptions of fixing it could make things worse.
Yes, and I would also say, and this is something that I assume from what I've read that we agree on, is that if you have inchoate or free-floating anger, disappointment, rage even, a feeling that you've gotten a raw deal, and Obama and his people are not able to frame a narrative that makes it clear how that happened and that they are on your side trying to right the ship, that anger will elect Republicans in Massachusetts and much worse, as you say, because it may lead to policies in response to that anger, in response to the perception of voter behavior, that will just make things worse.
Exactly, and you can see that so clearly. Absolutely obvious, should be obvious, that the policies of the Bush administration, the policies of deregulation, led to this crisis. If one faults Obama, it was only that he didn't take strong enough actions to correct the mistakes. Politically, you can say, well, he wasn't as forceful in pointing the finger at what was to blame, trying to reconcile, trying to make, you know, saying we're not in the game of finger pointing. But unfortunately, unless you have a clear view of how we got into the mess, you're not going to be able to figure out how to get out of the mess. And that's why one has to understand it was unfettered markets. It was inadequate regulation. It was the financial markets themselves that got us into the mess. And so the response to say we therefore have to strip away government, which is what the Tea Party group are doing, is bringing us back to what caused the crisis rather than repairing it.
Yeah, if you try to pacify them by giving them a little of what they think they want, you know, you're cutting off the chances of them actually get the benefits of a recovery.
Well, I think, you know, the point of having the bully pulpit is to try to explain what happened calmly. You don't have to say I told you so. You don't have to say you don't have to show anger, although there's plenty of reason why one might be angry. But one ought to point out that economic theory and a host of historical evidence was already providing a prediction, an explanation for why this stripping away of the regulations and not adopting new regulations
that could keep up with the new innovations and the speed and so on
was predictably going to lead us into difficulties.
Yeah, yeah. Let me just deal with one of your other earlier books, because again, I find it so in the $3 trillion war. You wrote, Americans could and should have asked, are there ways of spending that money, and for that you're referring to the $3 trillion that will ultimately be spent in Iraq and Afghanistan?
Or was that the numbers are larger now, because we said at the time that we wanted to be conservative, so we wouldn't get into a nitpicking discussion, is it $3 trillion or $2.9 trillion? We wanted to make sure that everybody would agree that we had underestimated.
So then you could deal with the ramifications, yeah.
Exactly, and as time has gone on since we wrote the book, the numbers have come in, and the numbers are significantly larger. More people coming back disabled, more cost for each disabled person. So, and the cost in Afghanistan are much higher than in Iraq. So the estimates are somewhere between $500,000 to $1 million per troop in Afghanistan.
Per year.
Afghanistan.
So when we're up to 100,000, which we are now, I think, and for anyone who has missed this, we now have more troops in Afghanistan than were ever under the Bush administration, and the defense budget is actually larger than it ever was under a Bush White House. Staggering things. But you said, you know, take the conservative estimate of $1 trillion and so on. And so now what? I mean, if you put out that book again, you'd have to raise it to $4 trillion or something.
We'd have to call it the $4 trillion wars.
Yeah.
Wars. Yes.
Yep. Half that sum would have put Social Security in a firm grounding for the next 75 years. That's half of $1 trillion. If we spent even a small fraction of the remainder on education and research, it's likely our economy would be in a far stronger position. If some of the money spent on research were devoted to alternative energy technologies or further incentives for conservation, we would be less dependent on oil and more secure. The lower prices of oil would have obvious implications for the financing of some of the current threats to America's security. Here's one. For sums less than the direct expenditures on the war, we could have fulfilled our commitment to provide 0.7 of 1% of our GDP to help developing countries, which, of course, failing countries are the ones where terrorism is most likely to be. We could have had a Marshall Plan for the Middle East or the developing countries that might actually have succeeded in winning the hearts and minds of those in the Middle East. This you wrote in that book year and a half or so ago, not that
about
long.
About two years ago.
Again, could you update, which you already did, those remarks? And is there some, I mean, now you can substitute the bailout for those sorts of things and come up with the same sorts of numbers. But I wondered if there's some role that all of that spending in the war had at all to do with what we face now.
Yes, and that was a point I actually made in the $3 trillion war, that it was likely to contribute to economic problems down the road. And I have to say, what I had predicted came out to be true, and worse in some sense than I had anticipated. What I pointed out with Linda in our book was that because of the high price of oil and the low stimulus provided by war spending in the United States, normally spending gets recirculated in the economy, but if you're spending money on a foreign contractor working in Iraq, there is no secondary benefits. Because of the ways in which those things weakened the American economy, we had been induced to have low interest rates, and that low interest rates helped fuel the bubble. The bubble worked to keep the economy going, but in an unsustainable way. People were taking out $900 billion in 1 year alone out of their house in mortgage equity withdrawals that they were then spending on consumption, and that kept the economy going, but it was not sustainable. And now we are seeing the consequences.
Right. And as you point out, not the spending not slowing down at all.
Well, the military spending has not slowed down, but consumer spending has slowed down because they've had no choice.
Right. No, I meant the drag on the economy,
the drag
which
and
the spending, as he pointed out. In other words, what's the common multiplier if you spend a dollar with the government on a road or a teacher or something like that?
1.5 to 2. If you look at the long run multiplier, it's probably closer to 2. The short run, more like 1.5. But the multipliers associated with, say, paying money for a foreign contractor working in Iraq or Afghanistan, much lower than that number.
Right. And even if I'm not mistaken, the multiplier on a sophisticated weapon system is much less than on much smaller, more immediate spending?
Let me try to explain what a multiplier is.
Thank
some
you.
Of your readers,
you.
May, listeners may not understand. What a multiplier means is that every time the government spends money, it increases income, but then when the people get that income, they spend money, and that generates a second round, and then a third round, and a fourth round. And so the multiplier is what we say is the ratio of the total increase in GDP, national income, as a result of $1 of spending on the part of the government. So if the government spends $1 and we say the multiplier is 2, that means the economy benefits by $2. Now, where that's particularly relevant right now in some of the public discussion has to do with the deficit. Some of the conservatives are focusing right now on the size of the deficit.
And let's emphasize that word right now.
Yeah.
Because they certainly weren't.
They weren't doing that during the Bush eras. The deficit soared in 8 years from $5.7 trillion to, well, to officially around $10 trillion. But if you included the cost that we would have to pay for disabled veterans coming back, if you included the cost of the bailouts, then the numbers were much, much larger.
But they are now. Now suddenly, as you say, it's there's a fetish, as a deficit fetish.
Exactly. It's a deficit fetish. And what I find so disturbing is the short-sightedness of the financial markets is what got us into this crisis. I mean, they acted excessively risky, but also in a very short-sighted way. They were lending people beyond their ability to pay because they were getting fees today and let the future take care of itself. Well, again, they're being short-sighted. Because if we spend money on investments, not on wars, not on bank bailouts, but on investments in education, technology, infrastructure, you get two benefits. In the short run, you get higher GDP.
Because that money's being spent.
Spent in the United States, and it recycles over and over again, and you get a multiplier of around over in a period of several years of 2 or more. But then, because these are investments, they yield long-term returns. As the economy grows, the government gets more revenue. All it takes is about a 5 to 6% return on these investments for the long-term national debt to actually be lower as a result of spending today, which increases the deficit today. So our eye shouldn't be on today, it should be on the long run. And so if we have our eye on the long run, then this deficit spending will actually lower the debt. And that's not even including all the other social benefits, all the societal benefits that come from people having work, from a more prosperous society, from addressing all the kinds of long-run problems of that our country really needs to address.
You know, one thing I heard there was that short-sighted thinking, short-term benefits very much fueled this the descent and the crash, and now it's short-term thinking to worry about the deficit today. I mean, it seems so, you know, so obvious that you shouldn't be using the same muscle that got you into it to think it's going to get you out.
Well, part of the problem is that we're drawing on the advice of the same kinds of people.
Exactly.
The people from the financial sector. And when I look at this, it gets me upset because it's, put it very simply, just bad economics. Let me just give you another illustration. Any firm, you look at what it owes, but you also look at what its assets are. You look at what we call the balance sheet, assets and liabilities. And no one would ever, ever look just at what it owes. If it has assets that are more than its liabilities, then it has positive net worth, and that's a good firm. Now, when you firm borrows, it increases the liability, but if it borrows and spends the money well, it increases the assets, and that's what creates companies, the most successful companies, Amazon, Google, all these companies. They would not have been created if they hadn't been able to get access to funds.
And if they'd had to show a profit the first year.
Exactly.
I mean, Amazon, 5, 6, 7 years.
So the point is that the financial wizards do not even understand balance sheets, at least when it comes to the public sector. And to me, it's almost mind-boggling, and to me, maybe the only way we can understand this is it's not about economics. It's about politics, and that's what we were talking about a little bit earlier.
Yep, that
they
is right.
have an agenda of stripping away government. Why? Well, part of it is to allow them to engage in the kind of excessive risk-taking that got us in the mess. Because remember, while our society suffered enormously, taxpayers suffered enormously, homeowners, workers, the bankers have done very well. They walked off with money, hundreds of millions of dollars.
I mean, they were made good immediately, and then because they didn't turn around and lend it, right? I mean, in other words, their turnaround has been really swift.
Well, it's even worse than that, because when you look at it, as we were bailing out the banks, they were taking money that we were told was supposed to go into help the banks provide credit, that we were told was going to recapitalize the banks, but they took that money and paid it out in dividends, paid it out in bonuses. And you have to scratch your head, bonuses for what? Bonuses for record losses. Now, we were told that those bonuses were, quote, incentive pay. Now, the nature of incentive pay is you produce more, you get more pay. But how do you reconcile incentive pay with record losses? And then you get a phenomenon. We began to see the charade that this all was. They decided, we'll change the name to retention bonuses.
Right.
And we can't call it incentive pay because that's too obvious a lie. We'll call it retention pay. Now, again, you scratch your head and say, why would you want to retain guys who have made record losses, who obviously don't know how to manage risk? Your business is managing risk, and these guys flubbed it. And at the bottom line, you say, well, you know, the system is working very well for these guys.
But it does seem that one of the senses is you'd think at some point they'd change course because at some point it would hurt. But so far, not only hasn't it happened, but they can't even see it happening yet. Let's go back to that three-part, those three big questions. The first one, how do we know it's broken? You know, what's the evidence? That one is probably obvious. But are there, having thrown you that question, are there any things that a normal listener or reader might not think of as evidence of the failure?
Well, perhaps I should mention that they will be hearing from some quarters that the economy's on the mend because the stock market is going up, growth has restored.
We're recording on the 24th, and Bernanke said that this morning.
Exactly. Now, officially, the recession may be over because recessions, by the technical terminology, are two or more quarters of negative growth. But for most Americans, the economy is in recession if they can't get a job. The unemployment rate, I mentioned before, that more than one out of six Americans who would like a full-time job can't get it. The long-term unemployed has increased phenomenally. 40% of the people unemployed
have been unemployed six months or more.
More. And
that's two out of every five people unemployed has been unemployed. And people say, and even Bernanke mentioned, that has long-term consequences. People get they begin to lose skills, they begin to lose freshness, they begin to become more difficult to be reemployed.
Exactly. And we know from historical experiences that if that persists for very long, and we've already had it persisting, it's going to be very difficult to get back to, you might call, a normal, or I would view acceptable level of unemployment. Numbers, people are talking about it being the middle of the decade before we get back to normal unemployment, and I think that's probably optimistic.
Oh my God.
Unless, of course, we take much stronger actions, and so far we've been taking small steps, but not big enough steps.
And I would throw in another thing, tell me if I'm right, but it also seems to me that given this pain, that the fraying of our safety nets, because all of our, so many of our states are in enormous financial problems, exacerbates the pain. And so this idea that we're recovering or in, you know, in a recovery has begun is not touching most people.
That's right. In fact, one of the concerns that I have is that we aren't helping the states as much as we should. The shortfall in state revenues across the country is around $200 billion a year. That's a negative stimulus. In other words, because the states have balanced budget frameworks, when their revenues go down, they have to either cut back expenditures or raise taxes. That dampens the economy. So the result of this is the economy is weaker and people are not getting access to the services they need. What also concerns me is the long-run impact. We were talking about the long-run impact of the unemployment. The UK has taken a very different approach. What they've said is, I was talking to the Prime Minister on this, he said, you know, we want to make sure that every young person who is not in a job is in school. Because if they're not in a job, they're not building up skills, potential for long-run problems. And so we want to make sure there's a place for them in a vocational training and a higher education. What I've been seeing going around California and other places is there have been cutbacks in higher education. We should be taking advantage of this opportunity to upgrade our skills. I mean, already in standardized global tests, the United States does not perform as well as many other advanced industrial countries. In fact, not as well as some emerging markets. And so this should be on our priority.
Right. And just for anyone who's forgotten, when someone says, you know, that my guest and I both feel that the Obama's responses have been inadequate, but one place that it was so absolutely clear was when on the first stimulus package, they negotiated with the Republicans and negotiated away $40 billion to states and got not a single vote for it. And it looked to me at that moment that no money would have been spent quicker than the $40 billion that would have gone to states that were running shortfalls.
Yeah, that's a really important point, because one of the things when you were trying to stimulate the economy and you had a magnitude of the freefall that we were in at that moment, you wanted to get the money into the economy quickly. It was sort of like intravenous feeding.
Yes, exactly.
And nothing would have done better, and nothing has been as bad for morale as all over the country teachers, nurses, public employees being laid off.
Yeah, you know,
or
I read
putting a furlough.
I read something the other day that it was someone's op-ed, but it was interesting. He said the EU is coming to the aid of Greece better than the United States came to the aid of California. In the scheme of things, Greece is, I think, 2% of the EU, and California is a significant, something like 13, 15% of the U.S.
More than that. But it was this framework that was lacking. But the overall size of the stimulus was also inadequate. Interesting that the chairman of the Council of Economic Advisers said that what was needed was something like $1.2 trillion. It was something that I said, Paul Krugman, that we needed a lot bigger stimulus. But the president was not given that option. There's obviously a political judgment. Could he have gotten it through? Remember, this is right after he got elected. He had a 70% approval rate.
And everyone was still in the fear from the September events.
Exactly. And it was so clear that Bush had messed up. And this was the moment to take a strong
And they
action.
Also could have said, look, if we just give the people the same amount we gave the banks. And they didn't. It was less.
Exactly. Now, that was not the only flaw, in my judgment, of where they went wrong. When they began pouring money into the banks, what I, you know, sort of like trickle-down economics, we throw enough money at the banks and eventually everybody will benefit, I said we ought to try trickle-up economics. Giving money to the banks in that magnitude was sort of like giving a mass blood transfusion to a patient suffering from internal hemorrhaging and not doing anything about the underlying problem. The underlying problem that started the whole thing was the bubble we were talking about. And the bubble meant that when it broke, foreclosures began apace. Unfortunately, while Obama did a little bit, it was not enough.
And in other words, are you saying that if a really sizable, a really hefty infusion had gone directly to those homeowners who were in threat of foreclosure, that that money would have then gone to the banks, but through those people, thus keeping them in their homes, and psychologically the message to the country would have been enormous? Is that basically what you're saying?
It would have at least benefited ordinary citizens.
In addition to the banks.
In addition to the banks. The result of not doing this is that the number of foreclosures expected in 2010 is larger than 2009, larger than 2008. Numbers that are bandied around are 2.5 to 3.5 million this year. And many of these are lower income people who are, and even middle income people, for whom the house was their most important asset. As they lose their house, they lose their life savings, they lose their dreams, they lose their potential of a comfortable retirement. As I talk around to people, the level of anxiety that has resulted is enormous.
Yeah, I'm sure most people do not know that there are more foreclosures expected this year than the last 2 years, and that the commercial real estate market is feeling its effects this year, too. There was a delay in commercial real estate,
that's
correct?
Right. This is the next step, shoe to fall, and it's expected to be very serious. About $500 billion of commercial real estate mortgages have to be rolled over in one way or another in the next 3 to 5 years per year. And like the residential mortgages, many of them are underwater. About 1 out of 4 residential mortgages are underwater. They owe more money than the value of the property, and particularly true in a number of the states. But the same thing is true in a lot of the commercial real estate. But because the bank supervisors have been told, look at you closed your eyes, you held your nose, and you pretended that there weren't problems in the past, you have to do a better job, and so they're going to be more reluctant to just pretend that these are not underwater. And even worse, many of these are securitized. And securitization presents a whole new set of problems that we are not used to. This is one of those great innovations that the financial sector really didn't think through. The result of that is, with the securitization, is how are they going to roll it over? Answer is, probably they won't.
Yeah.
And we've begun to see the first of these problems in New York, what was called the Stuyvesant Project, a multi-billion dollar bankruptcy.
It was one of the biggest commercial real estate purchases ever, and it's already falling apart.
And just a few years after the deal was done. And this is likely to be a pattern. The worry then is that the result of the collapse of the commercial, on top of the problems in residential mortgages, is going to mean that the flow of credit is going to be reduced. Already happening. The decline in credit last year was a record decline. And in addition, more banks are going bankrupt.
That's right. And by the way, when we think of credit, if we think, well, that means, you know, people won't be putting things on their credit cards, maybe that's not such a bad thing. But really what it also means is businesses can invest.
It's credit for small and medium-sized enterprises, really what I should have emphasized.
But I mean, it's, you know, it'll be all across the board, but it's that's where jobs come from, that's where futures come from, that's where whatever is going to be America's future comes from. And when that remains or gets worse in terms of being locked up, we're really stagnant. as I said early in the show, it seems to me what economics is supposed to help us deal with is risk and incentives. Those are two of the prime concepts. How did we go wrong on those two?
Well, one of the things I do point out in free fall is that we had bad incentives in the financial sector, both at the individual level and the organizational level. At the individual level, the bankers had incentives for excessive risk-taking, for short-sighted behavior. At the organizational level, they had incentives for excessive risk-taking. After all, the very big banks were too big to fail. And if you're too big to fail, you know if you gamble and win, you walk off with the profits. If you gamble and lose, the taxpayer picks up the tab. The result of this, we were in the process of creating a new kind of capitalism. I call it air socks capitalism, where you socialize losses and you privatize gains. And obviously, in that kind of fake capitalism, incentives get distorted. The problem of risk is a little bit more complicated. Here, partly the issue was they had incentives to engage in excessive risk-taking.
In other words, those same incentives for short-term gain and huge bonuses and so on, and it meant the quicker you churn things and so on, the more money you made.
And the larger your leverage, for instance,
right,
the better.
And if anyone doesn't know what we mean by leverage,
it means that the banks would borrow and borrow and borrow, and the ratio of what they had borrowed relative to their own capital was huge.
35-1, things like that?
Yes, and what that means, to make it very clear, is that if the value of the assets in which you've invested the money goes down even 3%, you're wiped out.
Because that's 3 times 35.
Exactly.
Yeah. And if it goes up, you're fine.
You make a lot of money. If it goes up by 3%, you double your money.
Right.
And they all focused on doubling the money,
yeah,
going up by
3%. You had an entire industry or an entire global industry that believed that that gravity didn't exist anymore.
Exactly. They believed that gravity didn't exist. Now, real estate prices have gone down 30%.
So if you were at 35, you've been wiped out 10 times over.
No wonder we had
to. So it means it wiped out every good investment you made.
Exactly. Now, not all of them had all.
I mean, that was extreme, and 35 was somewhat extreme.
Well, no, some of them were at that level.
I know. I'm saying not every bank was at 35.
Exactly. So the point is they were engaged in all kinds of excessive risk-taking. They were creating new products like these credit default swaps.
And that's one. That was a question within this question, which is their design, their claim was that would manage or reduce risk, and instead it actually amplified it enormously. Why?
Well, part of the reason was they didn't understand these new products. They were so complex that they were, in some senses, meant often to deceive, say, the regulators or the investors to make them think that they were doing better, move things off balance sheet. For instance, one of the things that's come out in the last week or so is the way Goldman Sachs used these kinds of fancy products to deceive the citizens of Greece about what the true fiscal position of Greece was.
That's right, and we've read the same thing about, I think it was J.P. Morgan did the same thing to that town in Alabama, county in Alabama.
It's been all over the country, everywhere.
So by pushing things off into the future with this fancy bookkeeping, you didn't, and it reminded me of Enron.
Yeah, a lot of, and they also, you know, pushed things off balance sheets so that you couldn't see what was going on. And that was a critical part of the freezing of the financial markets, because the banks knew that they didn't know their own balance sheet. They created products that were so complex that they couldn't understand them. Only computers could do the calculations, but the computers can only do calculations on the basis of the quality of the information you give them. Relates back to my theories of imperfect information, and the result of that was the computers made a little mistake and the whole system fell apart. So these products increased risk rather than managed risk.
Now, for a layman, how were they supposed to reduce risk? I mean, it's easy to say they were so complex and no one understands, but they must have had some, at some level, you could sell me and you could say this is how it will reduce risk. And what was that? Well, that it was an insurance policy?
They were described as insurance policies that you could buy an insurance on the risk of somebody going into default or some other risk of that kind. But what was interesting is that we have an insurance industry, and that insurance industry, the regulation in that insurance industry says that if you have an insurance product, you have to have enough capital to make sure when the insured event occurs, you can pay off. So if you buy fire insurance, the state regulator says there has to be set aside enough money that when the fire comes, they can pay.
And that's the norm in the insurance industry.
That's
and
the norm.
These credit default swaps, derivatives, and so on, I can remember Larry Summers bragged about how when he was in the White House, right, that he kept them from being regulated. And so that's part of the regulation that was not taking place?
That's right. He was actually Secretary of Treasury at that point.
Right.
And that was one of what he viewed as his great achievements, to make sure that the regulators didn't regulate these very dangerous products.
And so that was one of the regulations. You could insure things without having the money to cover it if it fell.
Exactly. Now, one of the amazing things about this was that the regulator in charge of these derivatives in 1998 said, this is risky, this is dangerous. And then, as she was saying this, yeah, an event happened that proved her correct. Long-term capital management, a large hedge fund, risked bringing down the entire global financial markets, and the Federal Reserve Board of New York came to the rescue, what was publicly organized, privately financed bailout. You would have thought that that was proof, but instead, Rubin, Summers, Greenspan did everything they could to make sure that Brooksley Bourne, who was the regulator, did not have her do...
She was pushed out, wasn't she?
She was pushed out, and a law was passed. A law was passed saying you could not regulate, because they were afraid that there would be another regulator who understood what needed to be done. They didn't want to take the risk, and so they passed a law saying you cannot regulate these things. And I want, you know, the listeners should know what the consequences were. One company, AIG, has cost the American taxpayer $178 billion. You know, the first number that they talked about was $89 billion. But when nobody was looking, more money flowed in.
Well, actually, and they were lucky in that the distraction was that what people actually talked about was the $165 million in bonuses.
That's
rather
right.
Than speaking about the 195, is it?
178.
$178 billion in bailout.
And you know, it's so difficult for people to fathom the magnitudes. And you know, it's the same problem.
One company.
It's the amount that we'll give in foreign aid, say, to Africa over like a quarter of a century.
Exactly.
It's the amount of foreign assistance to all the developing countries from all the developed countries over a 2-year period, and all of that went to one company almost in a moment,
and a company that produces nothing.
Exactly. It went out of that company elsewhere. Now, after that, we wondered where it went, and that was what's so interesting. You know, we've been talking about how short-sightedness led us to the problem, and then short-sightedness is again rearing its head. Well, this is a case where non-transparency led to the problem, and then in the solution, non-transparency was the word of the is what was at the center.
You know, one thing I realize we're not going to have any time to do, Joseph Stiglitz, is deal with the solutions you would advise, because we've got basically 3 or 4 minutes left. But one of the other ironies in this short-sighted, is the ratings agencies that fell down and basically, to me, were criminally negligent in the way they rated things, are now, they're the ones that are knocking down California's ratings. They're the ones that are knocking down New York's ratings.
And Greece's.
Taking money out of taxpayers because it means we have to pay more for every dollar we borrow, and Lord knows they know we're borrowing right now. And yet they're as criminally negligent as anyone else.
Well, the issue here is their models are flawed, and they have the same kind of short-sighted approach that has marked the financial sector, and they have flawed incentives. They are paid by the financial industry. They are paid by the investment banks that were creating the products. The financial industry does well when the interest rates rise. So it's almost as if their clients are happy when they announce something which drives up interest rates, which California or Greece has to pay in new bond issues. The reality is that Greece, Spain, California obviously have the resources to make these payments. You know, in the case of Spain, for instance, the debt-GDP ratio is only about 60%. If people were confident, the interest rates would come down to 2% or so. That would be 1.2% of GDP to service that debt. Absolutely no problem. But of course, if the rating agencies say it's going to go bankrupt, the interest rates soar, and it becomes almost a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Right. In other words, in Greece, it almost looks that way.
No, I don't. It won't happen.
No,
won't
I mean,
happen.
But I mean, but that was
it
the
would be.
Yeah.
If the Europe
yeah,
didn't
but
come
what you're
to,
saying is, California's not going to default, and yet they're being treated as if they're somebody who just bought a house with income they didn't have.
Exactly. And the irony is, the financial sector was effectively bankrupt.
Exactly.
Because they made bad loans based on bubble prices. They were reluctant to admit this. And because they've been so reluctant, we've been unable to take the measures that we needed to do to get us out of the mess that they created.
Yeah. Oh, well, we got to wrap this up. All my great plans of, you know, structuring it and so on, it's just so sort of exciting in the moment to just have the conversation. I really appreciate this time. Joseph Stiglitz's latest book is Free Fall, Free Markets and the Sinking of the Global Economy. His website is josephstiglitz.com. That's STIGLITZ, josephstiglitz.com. You can listen to this week's conversation and many others anytime during the week by linking to the podcast. You can sign up to have it delivered to you weekly either at terrencemcnally.net, that's terrencemcnally, one word, .net, or at iTunes. For podcast articles, transcripts, and to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net. If you want to receive my weekly email announcement of upcoming guests and issues, you can sign up there, or you can email me at T.E. McNally at mac.com. Thank you, Joseph Stiglitz, and keep up the good work.
Thank you.